Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them potato.
Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. Obviously, this has not been a good week. We're going to look at the deadly Paris attacks in which 130 people were killed, the aftermath of the attacks, and how the political focus in the United States has turned to refugees from Syria. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the new KCRW podcast, Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Juliette Kayyem, lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and host of the WGBH podcast, Security Mom. Welcome to all of you. Rich, I want to start with something you wrote for the New York Post this week about what you call treacly mourning. I have a question about it, but first, can you describe what phenomenon you were talking about and what you think is wrong with it?
Well, after the Charlie Hebdo attack, we all went around saying, I am Charlie, which is a very nice sentiment, but of course none of us were Charlie because none of us have the courage to draw cartoons of Muhammad and post them online at risk to our life and limb. And after Paris, there was the Peace for Paris symbol that spread online, which is basically a peace symbol with the Eiffel Tower in the middle of it. And it just seems to me this is very often kind of a substitute for thought about what really needs to be done and what's the nature of the threat we're facing. So I realize this is a bit of a churlish point, maybe even churlish for me, but we really need to go out and kill more ISIS members. We need to surveil them more. We need to have more police raids. So it's really a tough business that and having these kind of feel-good symbols online has really nothing to do with the nature of the threat or how to address it.
You see, I wonder about this because I feel like after these sorts of events, there's often this sort of round of grief policing and discussion about whether people are feeling the right way about what happened. And I just sort of look at it and, you know, yes, there are things that we need to do after this attack. But isn't this useful in as much as just people feel the need to grieve and not everything needs to be about what we're going to do to stop the next attack?
Oh, I don't have anything wrong with candlelight vigils and singing the French national anthem. There was a lot of that. But I think just changing your Facebook profile picture to have a tricolor filter over it really does nothing at all.
Bob, what do you make of these conversations? Because I feel like another thing I've been hearing a lot this week is sort of, you know, well, where was this outpouring after the recent bombings in Beirut, which also killed dozens of people? I note sort of oddly, one thing I haven't really heard is anyone complaining about how there wasn't an outpouring of grief after a Russian airliner was blown up out of Egypt. But is there a right way to respond to these events? And, you know, are we reacting the wrong way to some of these things?
Well, I don't know who the we is. I mean, not everybody in the world has said, let's go kill some more people. I think that is, for some people, a feel-good response. You know, they feel they're doing something, but it doesn't go to any kind of analysis of how this happened and what you could have done about it. And the fact is, just as with the Boston Marathon, with every one of these things that have happened, the people who were involved, in fact, were on the radar. They were known. They had announced themselves. And instead of talking about, you know, where they come from and how this can be thwarted and whether better police work or not interfering in the lives of their country and so forth, you get this emotional feel good. I'd rather people had a peace symbol or, you know, had flowers than say, let's go kill a lot of people. But if you're going to start killing, what about the leadership of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and other places that have financed the most extreme of Muslim movements. Where's the money flow? Going back to the original 9/11 attack, 15 of the 9 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. The leader of the whole thing came from Saudi Arabia. We could trace the money thing. So if Rich is right and you want to just go kill people, who are you going to kill? There's only 30,000 people, as I understand it, in ISIS. Do you really think if you eliminate all 30,000, you've solved this problem? And it seems to me, Bernie Sanders gave a great speech at Georgetown yesterday, tracing our involvement in this region and in the world, and showing how a great deal of mayhem has come from it. And only recently, let me conclude, that on this show, the big enemy were the Shiites of Iran. Now suddenly, it's the Sunnis backed by Saudi Arabia. Well, why is Saudi Arabia our biggest buddy? And so if you don't get into the historical antecedents of this event and then try to talk about how you deal with them, you're just doing feel-good politics, even if what you're advocating is random murder.
Juliet, one reason that I want to speak up for this sort of, these arguably empty symbols of grief is that I think one of the alternatives is something that Bob has just gone into, which is this something must be done impulse. And sometimes the thing that we decide must be done turns out not to have been the right thing. And I think grief allows us to pause. One of the things that it seemed had to be done in the United States this week was, all this focus shifted to refugees from Syria, and the House of Representatives passed a bill to make it much more difficult for refugees to come in. I mean, do you see that as just another manifestation of our grief? And what's the impact of that going to be?
Oh, I wish it were a manifestation of our grief. But just picking up on Rich's point, quickly, look, security. I've been in this field of counterterrorism, homeland security for a lot of years. I mean, security is, both policies that Rich was talking about and a sentiment. And so I actually don't see a world in which people are just doing the Eiffel Tower symbol. I mean, I see really tough conversations about what our strategy is going to be against ISIS, about surveillance, about refugees. So I think both are simultaneously and both are natural. As for the Syrian refugee issue, I don't get it. And I come from the world of security. It's outrageous on so many levels. But let me just make the security case for why it's outrageous rather than the moral and other cases that are as necessary. If you ask anyone in U.S. counterterrorism, why don't we have Europe's problem? It is because we have a large country. We're isolated by an ocean. All sorts of variables. But one of the major variables is obviously that we have done this experiment of integration and assimilation pretty well. Not perfectly. We've had issues in this country. I live in Boston. I certainly know that with the Boston Marathon bombing. But we don't have an epidemic like France is confronting, England is confronting other European countries. And that is because we have essentially been able to not radicalize various populations that are either here or that are coming here. And so for people who think that this is a short-term solution of the refugee crisis to just sort of close the door, it not only is a bad statement to the outside world about who we are, but it is, I actually think that the long-term consequences make us less secure. And I think we need to just take a deep breath and realize I have no doubt that we will look back at this moment and regret it.
Rich, picking up on that distinction that Juliet is describing between the U.S. and Europe, you wrote this week that we need a more restrictive immigration policy that doesn't create large, unassimilated Muslim populations. And I was wondering if you could talk about what that means for us versus what it means for Europe. Because when I look at it, it looks to me like Europe does have this really big radicalization problem. They've been receiving a ton of refugees, probably too many for them to properly integrate at this point, I would think. Whereas the U.S. seems to be pretty good at this stuff and is taking in very few refugees. So even if Europe should be taking less, shouldn't we be taking in more?
Well, the quality of the assimilation has something to do with the quantity, the number of people you're taking in. And when you have just the more numbers you have, the more likely you are to have enclaves that are self-contained and are very hard to absorb into your society. Now, they're obviously, France is a different society than America. We're a much more open society. There's much more of a kind of blood and soil element to French society that we have never quite had here in the same way. So that's an important distinction. But we welcome about 70,000 refugees a year and have been doing that for quite some time. And I don't see any reason to raise that level, especially considering that by the standards of the rest of the globe, we are quite generous. I think we have house about 20% by one estimate of the world's migrants, even though we only account for about 5% of the world's population. So I think we're doing our part. And if I could just go back to something that Bob said, he seemed perhaps to accuse me of advocating random murder at the end of his remarks and going out and killing members of a terrorist group that are waging war on the West and actually committing random murder and committed to committing even more random murder. That's all what they're all about, isn't random murder. It's just responding to an act of war against our society. And I also object to the notion Bob said, well, we've been just talking about Shia radicalism and not Sunni radicalism. No, we've been talking about this problem of ISIS for quite some time, and it is entirely predictable that if you gave such a group a safe harbor, that they would use it to plot and recruit against the West. It's inevitable. It's an Aesopian kind of phenomenon with the scorpion and the frog. They attack us because that's what they exist to do. And if you give them the room to do it, sure enough, they're going to come in the West and hit us. And innocent people going to a concert or sitting outside at a restaurant are going to be the ones who pay the price.
From the polling I've read, the public seems to be resistant to the idea of refugees. And there's a question of, you know, exactly how resistant. But it's clear that Congress is reacting to public opinion here. And opponents of more restrictive refugee rules have been saying it's un-American. And they, you know, point to what's on the Statue of Liberty. But I guess the question is, if it's un-American, who lost the public on this and why? Why is it such a difficult sell to the American public?
Well, I don't know that it is. I think you can fan the fires, irrational fires of hostility to the other. You can scapegoat. I'm really amazed that this hasn't been blamed on Mexican and Central American immigrants coming through that porous border from Mexico. You know, that was supposed to be the big security threat, right? Now Donald Trump wants to track every Muslim. Do they also come through that border? So it's totally irrational. It's totally scapegoating. And the people who, first of all, did the shooting, are they Syrian refugees? Is there some new evidence to support that? This is nonsensical. What is real here is that you have a religious fanatical offshoot of Sunni Muslim religion that you can trace to funding from Saudi Arabia. You can trace to U.S. involvement in Afghanistan with the freedom fighters that Ronald Reagan, you know, called the Mujahideen. You can trace it to intervening in Iraq and smashing a Sunni population and creating a basis for recruitment of people sympathetic to al-Qaeda. The reason I brought up Iran is that we have totally ignored the religious fratricide in the region, and we were focused very much on Iran, which is, after all, the Shiites are victims of the Sunni fanaticism, number one. Secondly, the reason I said random killing, Richard's statement was we have to go out and kill more. Okay, but who are you killing? Where is the leadership?
Then I said members of ISIS.
I know, but it, all fun and games aside, the fact is we are bombing members of ISIS all the time. Even the Russians are supposed to be doing it. The French are doing it. So they are being killed all the time. That doesn't seem to change the dynamic. I would point out the people who did this crime were known. They were spotted. They bragged about it. And what we're really talking about is traditional police work failing. It's again, as with the Boston bombing, they were known. One of them had actually been jailed before. This is not a refugee problem at all.
I want to get Juliet in here quickly, and then we need to go to a break.
Well, I want to pick up on Rich's point because I know what he was saying, and I think it's important that we understand what the concern is with the Obama sort of, you know, philosophy or what they're doing in Syria. So just this idea of more, right? So more killings, more this, more that. I get it. And I think, though, it's incumbent on people who are pushing to do more, in quotes, what that exactly means. And if it means a serious discussion about boots on the ground or more U.S. forces, and I'm not saying 300,000, but even more U.S. forces, what people have to remember is that we had 500,000 U.S. forces between Iraq and Afghanistan for 14 years, and the London bombings happened, the Spain bombings happened, Mumbai happened. I mean, we have to rethink what security means. And it cannot be that nothing bad will ever happen. It means that fewer bad things will happen so that ultimately when we disrupt this present threat, it won't have the same consequences that it had this last Friday. But, you know, I think I understand what Rich is saying. And then I think we have to have the serious discussion of what does more in quotes mean.
Well, let us know what you think about the attacks in Paris at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account at @LRCKCRW. We'll be back with more after the break. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the book They Know Everything About You. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Juliette Kayyem of Harvard's Kennedy School is also with us. So, Juliette, I think one thing people in the U.S. really want to know is, you know, what will keep us safe from attacks like this? And you talked some about how Europe has done some things wrong and is more vulnerable to this sort of stuff than we are. Can you talk specifically about what Europe can do to emulate the U.S. and be more secure from these sorts of things, and what lessons are here from what's gone wrong in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, this is so culturally contextual and historically contextual. It's hard to say, well, France, you have to be more like the United States. As Rich was pointing, I mean, we're just a larger nation in terms of population. We are isolated. But my point about sort of focusing on our assimilation and our acceptance of new groups is to say that if we start to head in a different direction, whether it's focusing on Syrian refugees, which, like, I still don't get. I mean, the facts are clear. These were French terrorists, right? Or this kind of craziness that we're hearing in the last 48 hours about going after mosques or, you know, having Muslims register. Those kinds of attitudes are actually very common in France, right? People talk publicly about it. So it's important that people from both sides of the aisle condemn that kind of radicalization or radicalism on the other side. I will say, just from the security side, and I'm not fatalistic about threats. I have spent a career trying to minimize them. But just one way to think about what the United States is doing right and sometimes what it does wrong is that it minimizes the risk, and if that's the surveillance, that's the strong immigration controls that we do have, despite what you hear out there. It is minimizing risk, maximizing the protections that we see, for example, in New York City today. You know, I was there this morning with sort of a larger police presence and bomb sniffing dogs. And then the part that we never talk about, which clearly came into play in Paris, is sort of supporting our first responders, getting communities and populations ready for response and what it will look like. And this is where we can learn a lot from what happened in France. One of the sort of takeaways is, you know, the lessons learned from what happened in the sports arena, the very smart decision to have the delayed evacuation. Absolutely brilliant. I'm convinced that saved a lot of lives. The use of what Facebook did with having that new icon that tells, you know, people can say I'm alive, Uber dropping its surge rate, Airbnb telling their French hosts to open up their homes. That's also part of our security apparatus. So those are the three pieces, if we think about what America can sort of, what the United States can focus on, because I just never talk about zero risk. In our country, you can't talk about zero risk. We're going to have risk.
Bob, I thought it was interesting, the conversation about surveillance and encryption that happened this week, because as soon as the attacks happened, there was this rush to talk about how we've been made so much less safe because of the Snowden revelations and both surveillance we couldn't do and surveillance that terrorists came to know about. But then we discovered that, like, the terrorists were planning this with unencrypted cell phones and texting each other. What did you make of that conversation?
Well, it shows how irresponsible our so-called national security figures are. They all rushed on television, the head of the FBI, the CIA, everything else. Oh, if we could just spy on Americans, more, then there would be no problem. And the fact is, once again, we have not had a solid instance where encryption protected the terrorists. It's just simply not true. And in this case, they wanted to say that right away. But on the other hand, this was being done on unencrypted messages. And I do want to challenge two basic assumptions here. One is that this stuff just happens without any responsibility on the part of the United States or France. Why are all these people living in France? They're the people who came after past imperial adventures. Remember, did you ever see the Battle of Algiers? You know what the whole history of France was in the region and in other regions. And there was a notion that somehow you could do this without blowback, without consequence. Iraq was not a place where terrorists had a field day. Saddam Hussein, whether you hate him or whatever, the fact is that al-Qaeda could not operate in Iraq. Before we decided to topple the leader of Syria, again, this was not a place. And the same thing was true in Libya. These were secular dictators, and we decided to do regime change, we being the United States government. And then everybody forgets the consequence. There was no big problem of Iraq or Syria being a center of terrorism before this. And the fact is that no one wants to discuss the people that we supported against Assad in Syria are, in fact, a number of them, the most significant fighters are people who were sympathetic to al-Qaeda and to ISIS. That's how they've grown militarily. So why don't we ever talk about the consequence of politics? And that's why I thought Bernie Sanders' speech at Georgetown was really set a very high standard. He traced it back, in the case of Iran, to the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh and our meddling there and the creation of the Shah's regime and so forth. And he labeled Saudi Arabia and Kuwait as sponsors of this Sunni terrorism and the horrible messages they're spreading throughout the world. That hasn't come up once even in this discussion. Why do we have a foreign policy of supporting Muslim governments that support the extremes of this movement? They don't get regime change. We don't ever talk about regime change in Saudi Arabia. And did we really make this a safer world by going into Iraq and then trying to overthrow Assad and overthrowing Gaddafi? Did that improve the terrorism situation?
Rich, I'm wondering what you think about the political reaction we've seen in the U.S. and sort of trying to understand, you know, where this comes from and how to prevent more of it. And particularly, you know, I mean, we've seen Donald Trump this week responding to a question from a Yahoo News reporter indicating openness to creating a government database of Muslims and tracking them in some way. Now, I'd note this wasn't an idea that Trump himself floated initially, but he wouldn't say no. And then he got asked about it again by the Associated Press, and he still wouldn't say no. And what does this say about American politics, that that's the idea that the leading candidate for the Republican nomination is at least unable to say, no, that's unconstitutional and stupid?
Well, as you know, I'm not a great defender of Donald Trump. I do think he's gotten a slightly bad rap on this because he kind of says yes to everything. You could ask him, you know, should we drop a nuclear bomb, you know, on Raqqa? And he said, we have to be open to everything. We have to consider everything very closely.
But that would be a bad answer.
It would be a bad answer. It wouldn't be an answer you'd expect from
well, it wouldn't be
a
bad. It would be evil.
Politician.
Wouldn't it be an evil,
but
wouldn't it be an evil
sorry,
answer?
Bob, if I just finish.
But why are we making light of that?
So he was kind of talking about the wall, even though he'd been asked about the database. But obviously, the database is completely ridiculous. It would be unconstitutional and would never happen. But Trump, despite the conventional wisdom, has kind of gained from this moment because he's a fierce nationalist. He's a hardliner on immigration. And people think we've been too soft and weak around the world and have been too open to all sorts of people coming to this country, many of whom we know nothing about.
I'm sure Rich and I disagree on sort of Obama's strategy, but I will critique Obama in this regard. I think people are really nervous, and maybe because I'm a mother of three and hear it from the nervous mothers or whatever. Paris really did strike something different. And, you know, these were young kids at concerts. It could have been any of our kids. It could have been us, depending how old you are. And I think Obama has failed to capture that moment of unease He seems angry, and I understand that because I'm angry about this sort of focus on Syrian refugees. I think it really very few things make me, you know, so uncomfortable, and I find it horrible what's going on. But I do think him capturing a sentiment that Trump has, and Trump sort of displays it as anger, but a recognition that people are at unease. And I wish he would do that and then come up with the policy and then address why we don't ban the Syrian refugees or why we don't profile Muslims in America and sort of recognize that unease.
But I think it's not just Barack Obama. It's actually establishment leaders all over the Western world who have just missed this sentiment among the public of unease, but also of a feeling that there has been too much immigration and too much immigration from the wrong places. And these ideas have been impolite to express in public and impolite to express in the mass media, but they have an immense constituency, and it's led to the rise of far-right politicians and to people like Marine Le Pen in France. And I think that Donald Trump is the manifestation of that in the United States, and it doesn't make, you know, Donald Trump okay. What he's saying is awful. But it's something that happens because there's a vacuum. There are these concerns of much of the public that are just left unaddressed.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that what festers in the nervousness of the moms and dads and everyone else can head towards bad, as we see with Trump and others, or can head towards something that actually can be quite remarkable. And we have seen it in the past. You know, we saw a sort of common unifying moment, at least, you know, here in Boston after the marathon, or after Oklahoma City, or after 9/11 for a short while. And I think that's a sentiment we're lacking right now.
A quick point on the refugee question. I really think if the president were to come out and say, you know what, I understand the concern about these refugees. People are scared about this moment. Let's pause. Let's not do it. Let's instead pass a $2 billion program to help the frontline states that aren't taking just a drop in the bucket, sort of a symbolic amount of Syrian refugees the way we are with 10,000, but are absorbing millions of them, countries like Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. That would pass immediately, I would think, and it'd be something that everyone could rally around. Instead, we're having this poisonously bitter debate about what is really a symbolic amount of refugees, 10,000, which is a tiny, 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 tiny portion, and the money it costs to resettle and to give these people the benefits they're entitled to once they're here and the various welfare would support many, many, many times more people there in those camps.
I think you're right in terms of this is everyone's problem, and I've been to the Syrian camps in Jordan. This is everyone's problem. You're absolutely right. We should show more commitment, but we still take the refugees, not because it's the right thing to do, I have such great confidence in the process, but also because if we close our doors, what that says to the outside world, including to the right-wing elements in countries like France, will ultimately be bad for our security. I believe that.
But
Bob, if we can get you in quickly, and then we're out of time.
Yeah,
for today.
Let's just leave one fact on the table. We help create those refugees. We help to stabilize those societies. You're all acting as if this sort of came out of thin air. We decided to go to war and have regime change. And this massive refugee flow, none of the people from Syria yet have been demonstrated to be connected with this incident at all. But nonetheless, they are refugees precisely because we decided to remake their societies. And now you act as if it was an act of God. No, it was an act of American foreign policy that initiated
Syria.
It. We decided to do regime change.
We have a policy of
bombing and
extreme,
everything else. We support different factions there. What are you talking about?
We had a policy of extreme passivity in Syria. And Syria had descended into chaos before the Obama administration began to arm any rebels and managed to arm all of about 50 of them.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Juliette Kayem. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.